This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, but it'll be different for many of us who are used to preparing food for a large group of people or even reserving a spot at a favorite restaurant. Even though our celebrations have to change during a pandemic, we can still appreciate the history behind the meal, so long as it's accurate. Contributor and culinary historian Kyle Cherik joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about some of the historical misconceptions we have about Thanksgiving and why it's important to set the record straight.
Kyle Cherik, welcome back to Lake Effect. Good to speak with you again.
Thank you, Audrey, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. So, you know, we're often told the nice Thanksgiving story that inspires construction paper turkeys and pilgrim hats, but let's take a deeper dive into the
actual history.
Yeah.
So untrue. No, it's the whole story is painted that these that the pilgrims, which were truly religious fundamentalists, that were financed by a bunch of English business people who, you know, anyway, that they arrived on Plymouth Rock in 1620, December 16th or December 22nd, the historians argue. And it was this vast wilderness where nobody was there, and they fended for themselves. And then they, you know, they met some natives in the spring and they showed them how to plant. And then they had this celebratory feast because they were all living in this happy kumbaya world, which is like so patently false, I can't even begin to tell you. So every school child knows that Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492, and he arrived in the Dominican Republic, and he didn't even land in, you know, quote, North America, but an island, the Dominican Republic, and then a bunch of voyages after that. And like the race of exploration was on. And so by 1524, Verrazano, the famous Italian explorer, who was actually funded by a bunch of French merchants out of Rouen and Lyon, set sail with four ships. It doesn't go very well, but long story short, he makes his way over to North America, and he maps out the coastline from Newfoundland all the way down to Cape Fear, so like the Carolinas. I mean, he covers a huge amount of ground. He interacts with the Wampanoags, which are the famous Native American tribe that the quote unquote, the pilgrims then would, you know, interface with later. So this whole myth of, you know, they came to this sort of savage landscape is totally wrong. And after that point, or from that point forward, you know, by the time the pilgrims had landed in 1620, so almost 100 years after Verrazano's voyages, there had been no less than 250 different voyages over with slavers, with folks that were setting up basically pop-up cod fishing processing plants where they would dry it, and that you know, kind of slave triangle of sugar and rum and slaves and things like that had been going on for 100 years. Moreover, when the pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock, which really was about 35 miles away from a war zone that had been going on with other English explorers and French explorers and the native peoples, when they landed there, they saw roads. They saw multi-generational 100-year-old roads that the natives had basically, you know, created by this well-beaten path of going to the shoreline in the summer for all of the abundant seafood and then moving inward. And the great irony of Plymouth Rock is that French explorers, essentially a party not unlike the pilgrims, had been there almost a year before and realized this is not a good place to settle.
So the pilgrims were kind of late to the game, and, you know, we already have the French influence funding of the explorer and cartographer, Giovanni Verrazano, is that correct?
Giovanni Verrazano, yeah, which the Verrazano Bridge is named after in New York, which was one thing that he did discover. He actually entirely missed the whole, you know, like Cape Cod kind of thing, region, great harbors, he just missed it. So we can argue about how good he was at his job, but hey, it was all new and nobody knew, and they were going to take the stuff back to Italy and France anyway. So who's going to call them on it?
Right. So the myth that the pilgrims come and, you know, they're discovering this vast primitive world, that's just so not true.
Out of his journal, it says everywhere there was dense population and the air was so thick with smoke from their countless bonfires, which we could smell 100 miles out to sea.
So heavily populated too.
Heavily populated and extremely well developed. The agricultural understanding, I mean, now, you know, anthropologists like to kind of discern that about 65% of their diet came from the crops that they were growing, which is actually how we should all be eating. We should all be eating plant forward. But this concept that it was, you know, primitive land is just ridiculous. And when the pilgrims got there, they started stealing corn from the food reserves that the Wapanagogs had. And the only reason that Thanksgiving happened was because the Wapanagogs were having a major feud, beyond a feud, I mean, this goes to warlike levels, with a neighboring tribe called the Narragansetts. And the Wapanagogs thought, well, wait, you folks have guns and more people, and we should have a partnership with you because you don't seem to be leaving. So the Thanksgiving feast was really primarily a lot of venison. There was some turkey there and a lot of seafood. And it went on for 3 days, which I don't think anybody's ever done a Thanksgiving for 3 days.
No. And so how do we get from this pilgrim shiny story to regularly celebrating this? You know, this is before we're a country. So when did Americans, after our founding, start this tradition?
So our legit official is 1863 that Lincoln declares, but it goes back much further than that. And in 1789, in the 1700s, during certain battles, George Washington declared days of Thanksgiving. After the Continental Congress met, there were days of Thanksgiving declared. I mean, we had Thanksgivings going all over the place. And this really kind of continued. It was a woman by the name of Sarah Josephina Hale, who was the editor of Gatti's Lady Book, which was an incredibly influential publication. It was a magazine on the level of, well, we don't read magazines anymore, but I mean, it was like the New York Times for women. It had 150,000 person subscription in the 1840s. And she started a letter writing campaign actually in the 1820s to state governors saying we need this national day of Thanksgiving. And then to make a really long story short, I mean, this woman was amazing. She was a founder of Vassar's College. We have Mount Vernon as a great historical legacy because she basically made it so and raised the money and called attention to this. And she prevailed upon 30 states governors. And then Lincoln in 1963 said this could be a great day of coming together. And the South afterwards said, yeah, not so much. There were so many governors that fought this national day of Thanksgiving. And we really get our concept of Thanksgiving from an influential novel that she wrote called Northwoods, A Tale of New England. And a chapter dedicated to what Thanksgiving should sort of look and feel like, the same way that we have Dickens kind of telling us what Christmas is in the Christmas Carol, oddly enough, around the same time. You know, they kind of put those things in place. But, you know, I mean, even Jefferson Davis declared days of Thanksgiving. I mean, he was, right, he was the Confederacy general, but he, not the way that we think of Thanksgiving now. And so eventually it took on, but the Southern states really, really argued it back. And the governors in the Southern states, once we were a nation again, used to move the day of Thanksgiving around the calendar just to kind of make it difficult for people in the South to observe. And it really wasn't until the 20s that we coalesced as a country around Thanksgiving. And the pumpkin pie, which is very much a Northern dessert, you know, kind of migrated into a sweet potato pie in the South and other things.
So you mentioned moving the dates around in the South just in spite of following a Northern mandate, so to speak. But there's also another period in time when President Franklin D. Roosevelt tried to move the date for Thanksgiving as well.
Right, right. I mean, there isn't an American that, you know, Republican, Democrat, that doesn't think like, okay, FDR did a lot of great things, basically saved us, you know, met so many waves from the Depression and World War II and his social programs. And, you know, I mean, elected 4 times in a row, right? He's the reason we have term limits, basically, but in a good way. And in 1939, in the depths of the Depression, he tries to move Thanksgiving up 2 weeks so that we have a longer Christmas shopping season. And FDR historians will single that action out as one of the most unpopular things he's ever done. I mean, letters sent to the White House and senators saying, I declare that is not right. And, you know, and I mean, it really was important to us, this day of Thanksgiving, and it really grabbed hold of America. And of course, we've got all the famous, you know, kind of Saturday Evening Post paintings of what Thanksgiving should look like and so forth. It's become part of our national mythology, but the early beginnings of it are not. You know, when children sing the land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim pride, from every mountainside. Native Americans, quite frankly, could sing the same thing, land where my mothers and fathers died too, from, oh, guns and germs and colonialism. So I'm not saying that we should do away with the holiday in any respects. And as a singular holiday centered around food and a food historian, I adore Thanksgiving. And I hope that it will have healing effects for us this year. But it's we should also be aware of our history.
Of course, as you mentioned, it's different this year. So how do you think people are going to celebrate? And do you foresee people foregoing a massive turkey meal, or the food's changing? Have people been concerned?
I don't think anybody's going to miss out on Thanksgiving, but they're going to miss out it in the traditional way. So 46 million turkeys are consumed, at least they were last year in round numbers, in America on Thanksgiving Day. Which is a crazy number in the sense that that's roughly the population of Spain, which is the first place that the turkeys were taken when Columbus and his men came upon them, discovered them, you know, in a sense, and then they brought them back to Spain. And within Spain, it was a major industry. Turkeys were beloved as a food. But that works out to, we're roughly 328.9 million Americans right now. So that works out to about 7 people per turkey. And I'm including restaurants and home cooked meals and that sort of thing. The understanding of how people will be cooking now that I can glean from the foodie national space is that there is a great crying out for the recipes that people just took for granted, because they're not getting together with primarily a matriarchal, you know, experience. And I'm not trying to be chauvinistic, but it is a truth. And those recipes just happened. And maybe there was some participation in, you know, putting the, I don't know what, on top of the green bean casserole. And by the way, it's the biggest sales of cream and mushroom soup by Campbell's every year is right around Thanksgiving for that casserole, which I always have like one bite of. And then I remember why? But you know what? I got to have that bite. anyway, it's that deep understanding of flavor memories. And there's been this immense outpouring online of how can I recreate just a sliver of this within my own sheltered space. And that's what America in its own way collectively is going through this year. And I hope that we can find a way to embrace around that, because we don't have the Macy's parade, right? And football isn't what it was, and we're not traveling, and we don't have the expensive airfares, but we still have really the heart of it, the flavors that take us back in time to other memories, which are sacred and precious to us.
What flavors are you going to be enjoying?
Well, I'm a big dark meat guy. We have managed to figure out how to make a delicious turkey, which I think on the whole is typically a dry bird. Irma Bombeck, in one of her commentaries years ago, described the gravy as a beverage in her household. And I think we subscribe to that as well. So where people sometimes complain that there's not enough dark meat, we're always saying we should have made more gravy. I love a good sweet potato, and I am a follower of the marshmallows on top just once a year, right? It's kind of a thing, the green bean casserole. And really just being together with the people that I love and that I rely on and that I'm thankful for every day. We're lucky that we have a small little unit so we can come together that way. And this year, more than any year, I'm just so grateful for that.
Well, a very happy Thanksgiving to you, and continued health and safety.
To you too, and all the Nowakowskis out there.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is a culinary historian and essayist. You can explore some of his past segments at WUWM.com. You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at WUWM.com.